This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Scientists like James Hansen have warned the Paris safe limit of 2 degrees C is not safe at all. The Royal Society just published 20 scientific papers investigating the differences between 1.5 degree warming and 2 degrees. They find that extra half degree could have extreme consequences on everything from the economy to weather. To prevent that last half degree warming, the project also includes studies of low emissions grids, carbon capture and storage, and even solar geoengineering, blocking the sun. The editor for this project is Dr. Dan Mitchell from the School of Geographical Sciences at the University of Bristol, UK. Dan is also the coordinator for the HAPPI project, H-A-P-P-I, which stands for Half a Degree Additional Warming, Prognosis, and Projected Impacts. Considering the Paris Climate Accord still accepts a limit of 2 degrees C warming with 1.5 as an option, the difference is information we all need to know before it is too late. Dan Mitchell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, nice to be here.
So Dan, why does a mere half degree of warming warrant so much work from so many scientists?
Well, as scientists, we often look towards our politicians for the questions that they're really keen for us to address, because these might have large impacts on, say, a country's economy or the way it operates. So most of the time, we just deal with questions that we find scientifically interesting. This particular question on half a degree additional warming, for us, is very interesting because not only is it scientifically important, but our politicians are also asking us this question. So those two things together have meant that we were sort of very keen to look into the problem.
As I mentioned, Dr. James Hansen, formerly chief scientist at NASA, criticized the Paris Accord, warning 2 degrees of warming is not safe and not a viable goal for humanity. In general, Dan, what does this new group of studies say about that?
Well, you know, I think we have to be slightly careful when we say sort of 2 degrees is not safe. Previous to the Paris Agreement, there'd been very little work done on what 2 degrees would do to the climate system, and even less work on what 1.5 degrees would do. Most of our previous work was looking at sort of 3, 4, 5 degrees of globally average warming. So it's hard to sort of jump to those statements without doing the thorough analysis. So I guess our papers have showed that 2 degrees, we can detect the climate change impact on human systems. So for instance, health systems through extreme heat waves, or agricultural systems through changes in flooding and things like that. So yes, we have detected a climate change signal, which is detrimental at 2 degrees. But likewise, any climate change can be detrimental. So even at 1.5 degrees, we still see some problems with the climate system. The key point here is the less we can warm the planet, the better off we'll be.
It's a bit confusing to me how the Paris Climate Accord came out with two numbers, 1.5 or 2. Can you tell us sort of how that developed?
Yes, so often these numbers used are more political than scientifically based. You know, there's nothing magic which happens at 2 degrees, which doesn't happen at 1.9 degrees, say. They're just sort of convenient numbers where we expect we can avoid a lot of the impacts of climate change. So they're sort of rounded to the nearest half a degree, say. The 1.5 degree number was quite specific because it does retain to a lot of island flooding. So low-lying small island states may well lose a lot of their coastal lands even at 1.5 degrees. Between 1.5 and 2 degrees. Which is why they were pushing in particular to get this 1.5 degree limit in the Paris Agreement, so that they could sort of, you know, make some statements about how their islands would be sort of beneficial for that.
Dan, who called for and funded this large project you worked on the impacts of that last half degree of warming, as published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society?
Well, there were a number of different funders who funded the papers within the Royal Society issue. The papers I was involved with were funded by a UK research council called NERC, that's the Natural Environment Research Council. But different lead authors from around the world would have been funded through different organizations.
But was there a particular body that called for this study or organized it?
This particular set of papers, we as scientists decided to do it in conjunction with the Royal Society in the UK. But we did it because of the IPCC special report, which is coming out. And the IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So they are sort of the largest climate change body in the world. And they put these sort of regular reports together. So our special issue is sort of to help inform on that report.
I know that scientists don't want to be alarmists, that there's a caution built into scientists. But I have to say, I've interviewed many, and our climate situation looks alarming to me, and so are some of the paper titles in this new series talking about, for example, uncertainty, urgency, and the last gamble possible. Is it really serious what we're talking about?
Well, the main problem with climate change is, and specifically with carbon dioxide, which is the main greenhouse gas that we talk about, is that once it's in the atmosphere, it's very hard for it to go away. So carbon dioxide can stay in the atmosphere for thousands of years, which means sort of if we're not quite sure, you know, what a certain impact of increased temperatures will be, it's much safer just to decide not to put carbon dioxide in there, because then we don't have to wait for a thousand years to sort of see what our mistake might be. There are alternatives. We can take carbon directly out of the atmosphere, but we can't do that on a scale which makes any sense for the climate change problem, both politically or economically.
In a recent Radio EcoShock program, we heard from Chandra Bhushan. He's from the Center for Science and Environment in Delhi. He said that they have calculated for 9 months of the year, India is already at the 1.5-degree warming mark, and over 2 degrees for 2 months last year. Considering that more heat is still hidden by global dimming, I'm wondering, is it already too late to aim for 1.5 degrees of warming?
I don't think it's too late. I mean, with India in regard, India has been warming a lot more than many other regions in the globe. And the land surface has definitely been warming more than the oceans. So it's not surprising that we have these regions of, say, India, which have been higher than 1.5 degrees, certainly in the very high northern latitudes, for instance, over the Arctic, but also in certain parts of Africa, they've also warmed more than 1.5 degrees. But that's a very different question to the globe warming more than 1.5 degrees, because that's a huge amount of warming that needs to go on, if you consider the size of the globe. It doesn't surprise me that these regions have warmed more. I don't think that really has much of a bearing on if we can achieve the actual Paris goals.
Good. Well, suppose, though, that we reach a warming of 1.5 degrees C over pre-industrial levels at a global mean, and maybe some crops fail and drought or extreme weather become too costly for our economies. If it becomes obvious that 2 degrees is untenable, what would be the remaining options as considered in these new papers?
The most likely option, and the one that most scientists would favor, would be to do something called carbon capture and storage. So that is directly taking out carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and storing it somewhere else. The problem is that costs money, so we have to decide who pays for that. And in that sense, we might introduce something like a carbon tax. And all a carbon tax is a tax levied on the carbon contents of fuels. So that just means if you're going to burn X cubic meters of carbon-emitting fuel, you'd have to pay a certain amount of money. And then we can use that money to invest in technologies to take the carbon out of the atmosphere. So that could be one way. A more controversial way, of course, is talking about these geoengineering strategies. And by geoengineering, I mean changing the atmosphere in some way to cool the Earth's surface. Now, there's very few scientists who actually advocate for doing this, but there are scientists who advocate for research into this as a very last resort. And so two of the papers in our special issue talk about the ethical implications of that and what the sort of climate consequences might be of that.
Okay, now one of those papers is titled Solar Geoengineering as Part of an Overall Strategy for Meeting the 1.5 Degree C Paris Target. The lead author is Douglas G. McMartin from Cornell and Caltech. What sort of technology is envisioned here?
Well, there's a number of technologies that they talk about in that particular paper. The main one they're proposing is something called stratospheric sulfate aerosol injection. Now, to sort of break that down as to what it means, all it means is that they would put in very fine particles up in the stratosphere layer of the atmosphere. So the stratosphere is about 10 kilometers high and extends to about 50 kilometers high. And it's well known to the sort of public as the region where we have the ozone layer, for instance. But when we have huge volcanic eruptions, dust from those eruptions and sulfate aerosol from those eruptions travel up to the stratosphere and they get trapped up there. And what we see during those huge volcanic eruptions is that the dust reflects incoming sunlight, and therefore we don't get as much sunlight at the surface, so it cools the surface of our planet. And that's essentially all these geoengineering methods are saying, is we would mimic a large volcanic eruption by putting these aerosols into the stratosphere, thereby stopping so much solar energy getting to the surface. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, if we're currently in a 1 degree world, so our current climate is 1 degree warmer than pre-industrial levels. If we were to say go to a 2 degree world, and then we geoengineered back down to a 1 degree world, we wouldn't get exactly the same climate as we get now. And that's because the Earth system is very complex. And that's the real issue with geoengineering, is that it's not entirely obvious that if we geoengineered to the same temperature, we'd actually get the same climate. So that's where the research is in that particular paper.
Right. And the main concern voiced by many is that solar geoengineering may have unexpected consequences by altering cloud formation and or precipitation. What do the authors of this paper say about that?
Well, the authors of this paper and the other geoengineering paper sort of say this is, you know, by far the largest concern of their papers, and this is why they're not advocating for doing geoengineering. One of the papers does propose that if we were to do it, you do it in a very small amount to start with, and you would just see what happened. But you'd have to test this over sort of decades and then look at things like the impact of the aerosol falling out of the stratosphere, for instance, on precipitation.
Radio EcoShock.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. Can the world afford to reach 2 degrees of warming as agreed at the Paris Climate Summit? Not according to a series of new papers published by the prestigious Royal Society. We're speaking to a leader in that big project, Dr. Dan Mitchell from the University of Bristol. Dan, please talk to us about some of the large impacts expected in a world 2 degrees warmer, the level accepted by world leaders signing that Paris Accord just about 2 years ago.
So the impacts on the Earth system are very varied. So for instance, for storms in the North Atlantic, it's hard to see too much of a change in those sort of things. The 2 degree world. For hurricanes in the Atlantic, for instance, it's hard to see change in, say, where those hurricanes will go. But globally, changes in hurricane frequency may come about at 2 degrees. And so we may get more Category 4 and 5 hurricanes, not necessarily in the Atlantic basin, but sort of in various basins around the world, averaged together. In terms of extreme weather, there's quite a clear signal in heat waves and cold snaps. That's increased number of heat waves and decreased number of cold snaps. But things like the precipitation response, so flooding and droughts, that's a lot more varied, and it's a lot harder to tell the responses around the world for those. Certain regions, like the Middle East, it's quite a clear signal that they will get hotter and drier, which is, of course, particularly important for that region where there's a lot of sort of stressed tensions anyway. So the pitch is not looking great.
Well, what about one of your interests, Dan, the health impacts of a warming world?
Yeah, so climate change and health is sort of quite strongly linked on a number of ways. My work has focused a lot on the extreme heat and the extreme cold, and there's a very clear signal in both of those that if the population of the world stayed the same, we would see increased heat-related deaths and decreased cold-related deaths. However, the population of the world's not going to stay the same. It's going to increase. More people are going to move into cities. Cities retain heat. So there's going to be an even stronger signal there. There'll be certainly a higher proportion of our population will be the elderly generation as we sort of more able to care for the elderly. And therefore, we're going to see sort of very strong changes in the number of deaths in the future, which is something we need to sort of prepare for. Outside of the sort of extreme heat and cold, there are other health concerns with the Paris Agreement, changes in vector-borne diseases such as malaria and dengue fever. Though it's less clear that the climate change problem is really going to be an issue because there are such good medical interventions at the moment, so anti-malarials and the like. So we concentrate a lot on the sort of extreme heat side of things, but there are other issues, and I don't have time to go into all of them, but disease from flooding, for instance, is another sort of issue.
Right. It's a huge subject on its own. And I know on another topic that you were awarded an independent research fellowship by the UK's Natural Environment Research Council to, quote, study the link between the stratosphere and extreme weather at the surface. That's a fascinating topic. And three questions come to my mind. And the first is, can climate change or greenhouse gas emissions or any other human factor change the stratosphere?
Yes, that's a really good question, actually. They do change the stratosphere. In fact, greenhouse gases in carbon dioxide in particular changes the stratosphere in a fascinating way, and it's much stronger than the change we see at the surface. So at the surface, we've seen about 1 degree of warming so far. In the stratosphere, the change is nearly an order of magnitude larger, so 10 degrees. The interesting thing about the stratosphere is that instead of globally average warming, we actually get globally average cooling. And that's exactly what we expect from the theory of climate change. So this was actually even predicted before we observed climate change. We predicted that carbon dioxide would have to warm the troposphere and cool the stratosphere. And that's one of our sort of strongest bits of evidence for human-induced climate change is that actually we get that really strong dipole pattern. So there is a very strong climate change signal in the stratosphere, but to sort of extend on that with your second part of your question, does that matter for the surface? Well, it's a very active area of research, and it looks as if that climate change signal is not translating into anything too major for the surface. It's more to do with the natural variability of the stratosphere, which can cause some particularly extreme weather, especially for Europe and Northern America and Canada.
Is that related to the polar vortex?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, so the polar vortex, I guess it's more well known to the general public as the sort of region where we have the ozone hole. So we have a polar vortex in the northern and the southern hemisphere, And it turns out that the ozone hole is much bigger in the southern hemisphere, although there is an ozone hole in the northern hemisphere. But this polar vortex can be disturbed, so it can get broken down from time to time. And so actually only a month ago, here in Europe, we experienced some very cold weather, a lot of snow, and that was because the polar vortex broke down and it changed the circulation down in the troposphere. So it's those sort of extreme cold weather events which are really important. And you often see a very strong link between Canada, especially sort of Hudson Bay area, and Europe when these things happen.
Can you describe a couple of other papers in this study series that you think our listeners should really know about?
In terms of the Royal Society issue?
Yes.
So one of the interesting questions is, if you're a government, you have to make a decision if it's going to cost us X trillion of dollars to prevent half a degree of warming, but it's only going to cause half of that cost in impact damages. Should you really stabilize climate at the lower limit? Because it's going to cost a lot more. Now, there's one paper which deals with the economics of climate change. It's the Prates et al. Paper, and that discusses some of those issues in detail. So that's an important one to look at. Another important one comes out of our colleagues from the institute called ETH, and they look at the impact of the land surface on globally average temperature. So most of the papers look at how changing carbon dioxide can increase global warming to half a degree. Their paper looks at how if you just change the land type, so if you went from a forested area to a non-forested area, how big a globally average temperature can you get? And they find that you can get half a degree globally average temperature just from changing the land surface type, not changing their greenhouse gases at all. So that's, another important implication.
So, Dan Mitchell, we have this assessment now that 2 degrees of warming may not be tenable and the Paris Agreement may need some changes. So what happens now? Is there a next step where this science can get turned into international public policy?
Well, that's the real challenge. In the IPCC report that I mentioned, which is the sort of large intergovernmental report, will give some recommendations as to how dangerous 2 degrees is compared to 1.5 degrees. I think it's a little bit early to say that, you know, at 2 degrees we're doomed and at 1.5 degrees we're not. That's not what our report's saying, and I'm pretty sure that's not what the IPCC report will say. What we need to do is weigh up the balances of the change in probability of detrimental impacts at 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees. Weigh up the economic costs, the social costs, and then sort of make a decision there as to how best to proceed.
And what about at the national level? We know that America has officially turned away from climate action at the federal level. Are European governments looking at 1.5 degrees as the real goal? And what does the UK say?
Yeah, exactly. Europe is doing, in the UK, is sort of leading the way and really pushing for 1.5 degrees. Yes, the US government did sort of do an about turn on that subject, but actually, especially over in Europe, we've been really impressed with the state level US response. Certain US states saying, actually, we're going to really sort of try and help out with this Paris Agreement. So that's been really nice to see. Other countries like India, for instance, have, since the US have pulled out, they've really sort of stepped up and said, you know, we're going to really go above and beyond our bit to fight this problem. So countries are really banding together, and that was one of the sort of great achievements of the Paris Agreement. It's just how many people did come together.
But the hole in the plan is covered in the last paper in this series by Robert Verchik, where he says, quote, even assuming a heroic rush towards carbon reduction and adaptation, some regions of the world will be hammered hard by climate impacts, and there's supposed to be a loss and damage plan to help compensate those who get hit by climate but didn't really cause it and don't have the resources to deal with it. But I think this is where scientists and economists and the rest of us worry the whole thing's going to fall through and that we're not really going to help the other people who need it.
Yeah, I mean, there's big concerns there, and you summed it up nicely. But you know, what they're saying is there are countries, certainly in Africa as well as elsewhere, where there's going to be very strong impacts of climate change. East Africa, the Horn of Africa, is a natural example. Places like Somalia and Kenya and Ethiopia. And it is very unfair that these were not the people who caused climate change. It was the developed world. We had our industrial revolutions, and, you know, the UK is more to blame than most for that. And now we're sort of asking these other countries not to have their own industrial revolutions because it's going to harm the atmosphere. So there needs to be something put in place to say, okay, you need to be compensated for the fact that you can't have the same technological push as our countries did. And you also need to be compensated for the fact that we've caused this climate change and you're the one feeling the consequences. They're very, very tricky negotiations, as I'm sure you can imagine. And that's a very active area of research where I think we'll see more and more papers coming out. But certain countries like Bangladesh are really leading the way there. They set up a really nice loss and damage fund, which is used as a sort of preventative measure more than a compensation measure, in the sense that they use it to help forecast early warning for, say, crop failure, and then they can use that fund to help farmers change their crops or help them get the information they need to plant it at a different time. So that's where that sort of funding will be very useful.
We have been discussing a round of 20 scientific papers published by the Royal Society. They are in a special May 2018 theme issue titled The Paris Agreement, Understanding the Physical and Social Challenges for a Warming World of 1.5 degrees C above pre-industrial levels. The papers are open text. They're available free to the public. You can take a look for yourself. We've been speaking with the editor and author of the introduction paper, Dr. Dan Mitchell from the University of Bristol, UK. He is also coordinator of the HAPI Project, Half a Degree Additional Warming, Prognosis and Projected Impacts. You can find links to all of this in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Dan Mitchell, thank you so much for helping us out on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me. It was nice talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.